I got it, Kevin. This is so nice. Don't forget the tapes now. I kind of have to identify myself with two construction workers. Every day they would bring their lunch and eat together at noon. And one day they sat down to eat. One reached in his lunch bag, he pulled out a sandwich. He looked at it and he said, "Peanut butter. I hate peanut butter." Threw it away. Reached in again, he pulled out another ham and cheese. Said, "That's more like it." Ate it. He reached in again. Peanut butter. "I hate peanut butter." His friend said, "Why don't you tell your wife you don't like peanut butter? Don't bring my wife into this as I fix this damn lunch." I understand people like that. Because my name is Rudy Little, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so glad to be here with you great people. Now, I'm like Charles for many years. Jim H. kept telling me, "I'll get you up to Mount Eagle." Every time I see him, I got to have you up at Mount Eagle. He resigned from the board, and the very year he resigned, I got to Mount Eagle. But he said, "We got you here, didn't we?" Okay, and thank you so much for having me, and we've enjoyed it. In fact, Wednesday, my home group met, and that fell on May 4th, and May 4th is my AA birthday, and I was 34 on May 4th. But I'm way on the end of 35 now. How to say it? Going on 35, yes. I wasn't going to do this. Really, I wasn't going to do this. It just more or less forced itself on me. By having a doctor on the program. And if any of you people know Buttermilk Smith from over, he was in Arkansas, he lives in Oklahoma now. But he's a great friend, a good AA. And I was thinking some time back, was something Buttermilk brought about. And I had to work it in with somebody, a young man or lady, hypothetical, that comes into the program, looks at our program, reads the steps, and this simple little old program's not near enough to tax this great brain of mine. So they go out and a little more research among the professionals in the field. Usually the first professionals in the field we meet are the boys in blue. And they used to beat me about the head and shoulders and put me in their jail. But it didn't stop me from drinking. And as time goes along, this young man, somebody suggests that he go to church. And he goes to church. The people there, certainly they love him. The minister loves him. The congregation probably loves him. But they don't understand him. And then somebody suggests the family doctor. And the family doctor, not being very well versed on alcoholism, will probably prescribe some of those happy pills. And now have somebody probably duly addicted. And then, when all of these things, other professionals in the field, hasn't worked, somebody suggests possibly a psychiatrist. Nothing in the world does AA or myself have against psychiatry or psychiatrists. My God, we wouldn't have any jokes in this program if it wasn't for them. But this psychiatrist happened to be familiar with our program, suggests that he go back to AA. And now he's on up in years, like 35, this is 15 years later. And he sees an entirely different, deeper program than he had seen prior to that. But what I was leading into, Charles, seldom, very seldom, do you see just a general practitioner in the medical profession anymore? They are some part of our body is where their skill lies. And the thing Buttermilk was talking about, the fellow was in a dentist chair having a tooth extracted. The dentist's forceps slipped, and the tooth disappeared. Now, he's kind of concerned about some of that malpractice suit insurance crap, and he was afraid maybe that it had gotten into the trachea, the bronchi, and into the lung. I had better refer you to a lung specialist. Went to the lung specialist, and they checked as far as their specialty would allow them. Couldn't find the tooth, but we had better refer you, I guess, esophagi. That's what you call a guy that specializes in esophaguses, I guess. He went to the esophagi. He checked as far as his specialty would allow him. But thinking maybe it had gotten on down into the upper lower intestine, I better refer you to radiology. So they got him to radiology, and they fed him all that cotton and light bread and all that mess that they give you, and checked. Couldn't find the tooth. But to be on the safe side now, we better refer you to a proctologist. And a proctologist got him down in that bent knee position. He broke out the telescope. And he said, "My God, man, you got a tooth growing in your ass." you better see a dentist. Right? Just like the young man in AA, around the horn and back where he started. We don't know why any of you came to AA. I don't. I can guess. I know why I came. Some force, some pressure, something, some monkey on our back made us come into this program. And for a long time, I hear somebody say when they come the first time that I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and I don't believe it. I don't believe it at all. That got to save that job. Or they want to hold the family together. Get a wife back. What does Clancy say? Keep a wife from coming back. Hey, we don't know why anybody comes. But I can tell you this. Unless you come for yourself, and until you do, you more or less will not be successful in our program. I like to think that anybody that doesn't remember his last drunk hasn't had his last drunk. I remember mine, and I tell it about it often because I want to keep it fresh in my mind. I want to remember it. And I remember the summer of 1959. That was the summer that Miss Jean, my good wife, left me. And the way I know she had left me, Sparks, I got home from being in jail. I'd been in jail. And I got out of jail, got home, and she wasn't there. And the girl had taken practically everything. She left me a table, a chair, a little portable TV. Took all the silverware of all things. And I wanted, we had a young son, and they had gone back to Louisiana where we came from. I knew where they had to be, either with my people or her people. Started calling. Immediately after I found her, started that old alcoholic con, the promises, the lies, the tears, everything that had worked in the past to get this girl and our son back. This time she meant it. She wasn't coming back. She was adamant. And I kept calling until she quit accepting the calls, Jim. I'm going click. And I started writing the letters. Pour my heart out on paper, mail them to her. I remember one time I got hungry. Rummaging around the pantry, I found a can of turnip greens. Now, I wrote that girl. Did you ever try to eat a turnip green sandwich? She had taken all the silverware, didn't have a fork to eat my greens with. Now, what I'm getting at, things like that would just tear the heart out of an ordinary woman didn't faze her at all. And she didn't come back. And finally, Bob, I told her I'd make that supreme sacrifice. That if she'd come back, I'd go to work. She'd heard it before. She didn't come back. You know that. But we were living in Memphis, and I saw an ad in the commercial appeal for a job. Applied for the job. Got the job. But it was a job that required a physical examination. In the physical, they found I had a hernia. Didn't know it myself, but they found it. Tickled me to death. I asked the people if I'd have the hernia repaired, could I still have the job? They said yes. In that Baptist hospital, make it before noon. Writing that letter, baby. You gotta come on home now. I'm in the hospital. Gonna have major surgery. Gene didn't come. Gene didn't come. And I remember now, that time in that hospital as the very loneliest period of my life ever. And I remember one particular day sitting up in a chair in the room. The door to my room was open. And I was sitting there way, way down in that old self-pity, thinking about poor little me. I felt lower that day than I had ever felt in my life. Been in a lot of low places too, Ro. A lot of low places. Skid Row, jail, Pendle Farm. Pull that little hitch down on that Louisiana chain gang back in the 40s. But I felt lower that day. No family, no friends, nobody. I saw a man walking up and down the hall of the hospital. He was a patient in the hospital, just like I was. And he'd walk by my door, he'd look in, walk on by. Several times he did it. And once he came by, I just spoke to him, and he came into my room, introduced himself, and he sat down. And I started to unload on this man I'd never seen before in my life, telling him all about me and my drinking, my past, my broken home. I don't know how long I talked. I know he didn't interrupt me. When I was through, he said, "Did you ever think about trying Alcoholics Anonymous?" This man that the good Lord had sent into my room had been in our program and sober at that time for 3.5 years. Oh, my sincerity forgotten immediately. Could hardly wait to get that man out of the room. Write that letter, baby. You can come on home now. I'm going to get in Alcoholics Anonymous. Probably never have another drink as long as I live. Gene didn't come. But I worked and made a payday. And I went down, and she and the boy came back with me. I had back what I wanted. Never made the first meeting. Lost a job after about a month from drinking. Got another job. And both of us were working, and we were working hard and doing good. And for about 9 months, doing okay. Till one day that old urge to drink hit. We'd been pooling the money, paying the bills as far as it'd go, and didn't have much money, but I wanted to drink. And we learned, hell, all you have to do is quit your job, they'll pay you off. That's what I did. Latter part of April of 1960, I started out on my last drunk. And I drank. And I got sick. I remember the first stop. Over there by Crump Stadium, little old place called Stadium Grill. I went in, three or four sitting around a table. I joined them. I knew I had little money, and I'd been there, waiting on a line lots of time. So I was buying, they were lying. One of them told me they'd been looking for work all day. I hired every one of them. I have often wondered what the hell happened when they showed up over there where I'd quit from. But I drank, and I got sick and weak, and I know I didn't call home. And I know on the 3rd day of May, I got locked up twice that day for being drunk. Got out of jail the last time, decided I had better go home. Got back in my bedroom, took off all my clothes. Buck naked, I crawled between those sheets, sick, weak. Man, I was some. I don't want to ever forget it. Got between the sheets and was getting a little bit comfortable. And here she come. She had my belt in her hand. As she pulled that top sheet back, she whipped my ass from one end to the other. I was too weak to fight back. And that's when I hit my bottom. So did she. But I was too weak to fight back. And I said, I remember that man in the hospital room. And I said, would you call AA? And Jean said, no, you're the one that wants to help. You make the call. So I called. And old Pat Connell, Pat Breen, Pat Stokes was on the desk. Pat was the one who started Grace House in Memphis, and she's all right. Somebody will be out to see you, she said. And it wasn't long till Wayne came. And Wayne was my sponsor. And last year, on St. Patrick's Day, my sponsor died. And that was the first birthday he had missed in the 33 years. I miss him. Miss him very much. But life goes on and new people come. Wayne came in and he told me about himself. But he said one thing that impressed me more than anything else. He said, I haven't had a drink in 4 months. A lifetime to me. A lifetime to any alcoholic, 4 months. I didn't have a job, didn't have a car. But Wayne and his wife would pick us up and take us to meetings. And there were about 7 groups of city in Memphis in 1960, but that gave us somewhere to go every night. I've said so many times that AA is not an employment agency. AA is not marital counselors. AA is not a loan company. Hell, I've used it for all of them. The first open meeting I went to, a man came up to me and he said, I hear you're looking for work. Can you come to work tomorrow morning? I had a job. Things were going okay. Just one little hitch. Wayne was not a very forceful sponsor. At that time in my life, I needed to be told exactly what to do. And Wayne didn't tell me to get into the book, take the steps to speak up at closed meeting, ask questions. These things I didn't know to do. But I made the meetings. I didn't drink. I wanted to every day, but I didn't drink. Didn't make a 12-step call. I had joined Whitehaven Group. And after 10 months of wanting to drink every day, it was our week for 12-step calls. And for the first time, I put my name down. I got a call. His name was Jay. And I went to the man with nothing. I didn't have anything to give him. You said it. You can't give away something you don't have. But that's the way I went. He was being forced into the program. The boy was 51 years old, that's all. And his mother was going to kick his butt out if he didn't say no. But he was full of questions about this program that I had no earthly idea what the hell he's talking about. And it's embarrassing. It is embarrassing for an alcoholic not to have an answer for anything. I guarantee you, all over this country right now, in the joints, the world's problems are being solved. If Clinton would just listen, they would be covered. You ever think about it, too? You don't ever see a common laborer in a beer joint. Foreman. Superintendent. Own the company. You don't see any ditch diggers that, we lie. We do lie to try to impress. But I did continue to make meetings, making a vow that night that I didn't ever want to be caught in a similar situation. I knew a man to be successful in this program. His name was Bert Davis. And I went to Bert with the one question that I had. How can I get what you seem to have? Now, Bert was a man that would tell you. And he told me, you profess to be in AA, and you don't even know what the hell it is. But this program is composed of 12 steps, and my book says take them. So I'm dry now for 10 months, starting out to take the steps, which I should have been doing from the very beginning. I had heard a few things that I liked. When he told me that alcoholism is a disease. Kind of on this order. Alcoholism is a disease for which there's no cure. There's no way an alcoholic can control his behavior after he drinks. But he said you can recover if you learn to control your behavior before you drink. A kit of spiritual tools, lay down at feet, pick them up, put them to work today. So I had my tool kit started by attending meetings and talking to Bert and learning more about the program and seeing and understanding, actually. I understood the disease concept. But it was really a build-up, upbuilder for me to be called an alcoholic. You've all heard it, if you're an alcoholic as I am, the things that we have been called. And can you think of, my God, the adjectives that they can put into it before they get too son of a bitch? All kinds of nasty names. And now, here's some nice people telling me they want that I'm a sick man. And I liked that. I liked it. So I had to admit that I was powerless over alcohol. Very easy for me to do that. And I had to admit to an unmanageable life, unmanageable family life. Oh, I never did. I wasn't a mean drunk. I don't think many of us are. That abuse that we put mentally on these people is what hurts the young son, I don't guess I spanked him more than twice in his life. I'm grateful to the program for giving me a lot of answers. I remember one time when the son, when he was more 15, 16 years old, he had out all night without permission. And Gene was at me, "You gotta talk to that boy, you gotta talk to that boy. Come on in here, son, I gotta talk to you." And we sat down in the dining room, and I said, "Son, if you're out with a nice girl, you shouldn't keep her out all night. And if it's not a nice girl, it shouldn't take all night." I will never forget that look of relief that came over Gil's face, expecting to be chastised severely and getting some of the best advice he ever had. Unmanageable work life. Every job I ever had, I lost from drinking. That's a fact. Unmanageable social life. No friends. If you're going to have a social life, you've got to have friends, and I didn't have any. Unmanageable spiritual life. I don't know. I was brought up down in Louisiana. I was Catholic. One day I got to thinking maybe that's the reason I'm like I am. Join the Baptist church. Presbyterian now. Doesn't matter. I found a God of my understanding in this program. And second steps that came to believe that a power greater than I am can make me as normal as anybody. We were talking about that the other day. Old Burton Crawford, moving out of Texas, used to say, "What is normal?" And he said he always heard is somebody buy his kid a whistle, then slap hell out of him for blowing it. But any alcoholic that comes in and says, sees our second step, and it says, "Be restored to sanity." And if I am, or you, has to be restored to sanity, then I got to admit I'm nuts, right? And no alcoholic likes to do that. I was trying to think of a definition for insanity that I read one time. It was somewhere along the line. Insanity is rather a legal and social term than a medical term. Is that right? And implies a mental disorder resulting in the inability to manage one's life and perform one's social duties. Exactly what I had admitted to in the last half of step number one. I said, "Hell, that's me. I am that kind of insane." Until I get to thinking sometime about some of the abnormal things that happened to me. And I remember down there in Louisiana, I stole old pistol. That thing was that long. And I out went in a pool hall. Pulled out my gun. The man that worked there said, "Give me the pistol." I handed it to him. But I didn't know his buddy was down the other end of the bar calling the law. And they got there in a hurry. Turkey walked me out there and I went to jail. Cocky, smart aleck, insane. That's what I'm talking about. Went before the judge the next morning. And he said, "Why did you pull the pistol out in the pool hall?" I said, "I guess I wanted to shoot some pool." Normal people don't talk to judges like that. That's abnormal. And I got 3 months on a parish farm. Coming into AA, I'll have to think about, we have to surrender, right? Our first surrender is to booze. When we come in, we have to give it up. We have to surrender and say, it's got me beat. The only way I can beat it is to give it up. Then we come along to the third step. And Juanita, how long do we have to give it up? One day. That's the beauty of our probe. One day is all we have to give it up. But then we come, or I come, to the third step, where I decide to turn will and life over the care of God as I understand it. And again, the surrender to me is for 1 24-hour, just like my first surrender, because that's what I'm in, a one day at a time program. I worked a long time with alcoholics. And I worked with Bert. Then I had this rented house in Memphis, and I founded the first place for old junk gals in the city of Memphis. It's a legacy I'm grateful to have been a part of. You ever see them? I guess you have. The first thing that gets drunk about a woman is her hair. And that's the first thing to do when they come into surrendered houses, fix their hair. Fix their hair, beauty them, pretty them up. Make them feel, give them a little dignity back. But over the years, I saw a lot of men of the cloth come for help in the program. Priests, ministers of practically every denomination. Wonderful men, beautiful men. And I would think, why? With all of the background, the theological training, the study that these men go through, why don't they stay sober? And I was just thinking one day, possibly it would be a lack of faith in their belief. They come in our program and they see our third step where it says, God, as I understand it. And you know, it makes sense to them. They understand that the God that they had been and had have enough faith in was the one that was crammed down their throats in seminary, where they said, that is what God is, that's what you will believe, that's what you will teach. But they didn't have enough faith in their belief. Oh, the little fella riding tricycle, now that explains it to me. It may not to you, but it makes sense. Little bitty fella riding a tricycle. And he rolled down a hill, hit a fire plug, he turned over, and he was bloody. He got up. And he says, son of a bitch, little bitty fella. And a preacher happened to be standing pretty close by. Says, son, you shouldn't say that. Say, Jesus, help me. Back up the hill he went. Back down. Hit the same fire plug. The front wheel bent double. The back wheel fell off. Bloody. He got up. And he said, Jesus, help me. Front wheel straightened right back up. Back wheel came on. Blood stop. Preacher says, son of a bitch. Makes sense to me. It makes sense to me. Something that we see in AA every day, a miracle. And yet, his faith was not there. It makes good sense. I told you, Charles, I'm just up step number 3 and it's just 10 minutes. To... But I'm not going that long. In 1982, Miss Jean got to feeling not good. And we went to the doctor, and they found she had cancer of the colon. She had the colostomy. They assured us that they got it all. But in 85, 3 years later, it came back, and they said it was big as a melon, they said. Inoperable. So I stopped work, and I stayed with Jean for the last 2 years. And I like to think that I did everything that I could for her to make her comfortable, to keep the place clean and to try to cook. And with all the treatment she went through, she wouldn't eat. And in September of 87, Jean died. And it hurt. It hurt an awful lot. I left Memphis and moved to Grand Junction. I actually left Memphis and I went to Grand Junction, bought a house, and left word for some of my brother's old big son-in-laws to move my stuff there, and they did. And I took off. Ran to AA people all over this country. And for a month or two, I stayed. And the furthest thing from my mind was drink. But I needed to be around people. It was so, or might have been so easy to question why. Maybe I did. I don't know. Maybe in a roundabout way I did. But either way, I got to thinking one day, if I question why, then I am doubting my God's wisdom. And it's up to that higher power that I believe in to say, when I will go, when anybody goes. Nothing that I could have done would have made it any different. Do you know, from that time on, I found it pretty easier, much easier, to make it through each day. Came back to Grand Junction, and I lived by myself. Was making meetings at Bolivar and Middleton, Tennessee, and around, and Moscow, and over to Holly Springs, Mississippi, and around, making meetings. And I did this for a couple of years. And I got thinking one day, you know, maybe, just possibly, there's a companion for me out there somewhere. Got to sending up them little silent prayers, you know. Went to a meeting over at Bolivar one night, and I sat down and I looked across the table. And the prettiest little old thing you ever saw in your life grinning at me. And I said, look at him. You ain't gonna be that good to me, are you? But he was. And let's see, Pam was 30. I wasn't but 67, and she was 31. 71 now, and she's still 31. It has been the great majority of the time so beautiful. Stand up, Pam. I want everybody to see you. God sent us a little old girl child. That son I was talking about a while ago, he's 40 now. Just celebrated 6 years in the program. He's over in Jackson, Tennessee. He's a chiropractor. Some MDs don't like chiropractors, but this one doesn't. But anyhow, his sister's three. He's 5 years older than his mother. Now, there are miracles in this program, right? Lots of them. Lots of them. Pam is an alcoholic. She's coming up on 5 years sober. And she said she felt like a baby in that Thursday night meeting in there a while ago, that we had, where I was just amazed at the knowledge of the Al-Anons. They surprised hell out of me. You know that? I had been always told that they were in our big book. I didn't take it, you know, like they're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. But there are a lot of beautiful Al-Anons, and I really enjoyed that meeting the other night that Roe held. That was just a meeting with all of us there, and it was good. I've enjoyed this whole weekend. I'm anxious to see what happens in the morning. But I certainly have enjoyed. I did want to throw this thing in here to the young people. And it's something I heard out in Texas. And it was about a preacher that had a saddle horse. A beautiful animal. And that old cowboy wanted that horse so bad. And the preacher wouldn't sell. And then one day he put the price up so big that the preacher said, "All right, hell, for that much money, I'll throw in a saddle." But he said, "I tell you this, the horse is different. I'm trying to throw something in here to kind of show a little bit about thinking. This horse is different. When you get on to make him go, you don't say, 'Get up.' Say, 'Jesus Christ.' To make him stop, you don't say, 'Whoa,' say, 'Amen.'" Paid the preacher, jumped in the saddle. He forgot. And he said, "Get up." The horse didn't move. Then he remembered. He thought, thinking a little now. Thought, and he said, "Jesus Christ." Out across that long prairie they went, tail and mane blowing in the wind. Look up ahead, a ravine some 300 feet deep, up right ahead, start yelling, "Whoa," and the horse getting faster. Then all at once he thought, and he said, "Amen," just as the horse slid up to the precipice. He sat up in the saddle, Mickey. And he said, "Jesus Christ." He forgot. And that's what I am asking all of you. Newer people, don't forget. Remember what one drink can cost you. I've never seen God, but I know how I feel. It's people like you that makes him so real. My God is no stranger. He's friendly and gay. And he doesn't ask me to weep when I pray. It seems that I pass him often each day in the faces of people I meet on the way. He's the stars in heaven, a smile on some face, a leaf on a tree or a rose in a vase. He's the winter and autumn, summer and spring. In short, God is every real and wonderful thing. I wish I might meet him much more than I do. And I would if there were more people like you. Thank you so much.